The views expressed throughout this podcast are solely those of myself and the guest and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of ATCC or any other institution. Hello, and welcome to Behind the Biology, brought to you by ATCC. I'm your host, Dave Yarmush, and this is our first episode in our series with Dr. Tasha Santiago-Rodriguez. Dr. Santiago-Rodriguez is a microbial data scientist and editor for Phage Biology. Today, we'll be discussing what we can learn from fossilized microbiomes and the modern science of transcriptomic sequencing. Tasha, thanks for being here this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We can jump right in. So you are an associate editor for Phage Biology and a microbial data scientist at Diversigen. That seems like a lot to tackle on a daily basis, but what do those two roles look like in your day-to-day?
Yeah, so actually my main job is data scientist at Diversigen. So as a data scientist, for the last probably 5-6 years at Diversigen, I work mostly on analyzing microbiome data sets, usually from internal projects. So I usually get, for example, a taxonomy table, feature table, functional table, and I am the person that is responsible to put that data together in a way that is easily visualized through plots, box plots, stack bar plots, PCA plots, all the microbiome plots somehow. So I do that on a regular basis. So as a editor in Frontiers in the phage biology section, I actually don't do that as a regular basis. And I started probably a couple of months ago. And I think it's something that I wanted to do as a person that loves to publish. I think it's very important to be involved somehow in the process of the papers that are being published out there. So I've been a reviewer for a number of different papers, but now being an editor with Frontiers, I think it's so important to be that person that makes a decision of the papers that are being published and the quality of the papers that are getting published.
Absolutely. I wouldn't overstate the significance of that. With regards to the data science, are you receiving sequencing data or has it already been processed into some kind of post data, like the taxonomy table, for instance?
Yeah. So I usually get a taxonomy table and just try to make sense out of it. So the people that actually process the sequence data, I call them the actual bioinformaticians. I consider myself more like a data scientist because I'm not really in the upstream process of getting the sequence data, QCing the data, processing the data through the pipeline. So I actually just get the taxonomy tables, feature tables, and process them somehow so they make sense for the people, the general audience, and the scientific community.
It's interesting you bring that up because there is just a subtle difference between a bioinformatician and a data scientist. Often, you wear both hats, right?
Yeah, that's true. I think those are actually the unicorns, the ones that are actually able to work with the sequencing data upstream and the ones that can actually do the processing downstream. I think those are very rare, but there's also the bioinformaticians that just work upstream with the sequencing data, just QC the data or develop new methods and software to process all the sequencing and microbiome data.
So within microbiomes, and I agree 100% with what you just said, by the way, but within microbiomes, the data you're getting, is it like widely varied or is it more consistently like MLST or whole genome sequencing or ITS?
So I get a lot of 16S data, metagenomic data, and more recently RNA sequencing data, which is something that we're just starting to look at. But it's a variety of sequencing data, but mostly like the common ones, 16S, metagenomes, RNA-seq data.
I could imagine that the RNA-seq data for microbiome research would be absolutely fascinating because that'll show you the interaction between the organisms in the microbiome, right? You'll see how they're impacting one another's gene expression.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating as well. And I think it's actually a data set that we should probably start looking more into. I feel like scientists are probably afraid of tackling RNA-seq data for some reason, probably because it's hard to do in the wet lab trying to get actually messenger RNA, remove all the ribosome RNA and all that, and then trying to get the pipeline running correctly, annotating the samples and trying to get a good database to annotate all this data, I think it's probably more complicated and less standardized than metagenome data. And that's probably why we haven't seen more studies around that. But I feel like that's probably a good step forward in microbiome research to look at not only what's present, absent with metagenomes and 16S data, but also look at what's been active, what's been expressed through RNA-seq data.
Right. So not just what is alive and present, but how is it actually living?
Exactly.
And I'm going to try and hold back on the database discussion because I could talk about that for hours. I'm curious what microbiome databases are out there. I'm not super familiar with that space. But you do a lot of work with the skin microbiome, right?
Yeah, so I actually started working with skin microbiomes probably 2-3 years ago with Diversigen. But you probably noticed we have a couple of reviews out there, webinars and posters. So I actually started to work on it a couple of years ago. It's actually a field that I was super afraid to start because we don't really know much about the skin microbiome compared to the gut microbiome. Mm-hmm. It's a field that there's not too many papers compared to the gut microbiome. Getting actual samples and material from skin samples is actually more complicated than getting stool samples, which is way easier to do. And that's probably one of the reasons why I was so afraid of starting with skin microbiome. And also because I didn't know the techniques in the wet lab, bioinformatics and all that. But now as I know more, it's actually not as hard as I thought.
That's good, because the gut microbiome is absolutely getting all the attention. The implications of relationships to mental health and physical health are all over the place, to the point where I think it's just known in the public sphere that this is such an active area of research. What's more complicated about the skin microbiome?
I think it's because it's such a low biomass sample type and high host content sample type that I think it's more complicated to work with. Because I would think like if you sample a skin area, you probably will get more DNA from the host, like the human host. So you have to find the ways in the wet lab and probably through bioinformatics to try to remove all the host content and just make sure that what you're analyzing is actually your microbiome data, your bacteria, your viruses, your fungi. So I think to start, that's probably one of the main challenges with skin microbiome is trying to get material to work with and try to remove all the host content somehow.
Perpetual problem.
Yeah, and also I think people are still choosing amplicon sequencing for skin microbiome compared to metagenomes, for example. And I think it's probably more straightforward because then you are making sure that you're not amplifying anything related to the host or just amplifying bacteria through the 16S sequencing. And I know now that people are just realizing that we can probably use different variable regions of the 16S. So I know for the longest time, the V4 region wasn't accepted for skin microbiome studies, probably because the primers that people usually use, which were developed for stool samples or soil samples, don't actually amplify some members of the skin microbiome, mainly Cutibacterium species. But now we know that if we edit those primers somehow, then we can actually capture some of those taxa. So I know people prefer when they do skin microbiome, they prefer to do the amplification of the V1, V3 region of the 16S because they're able to capture these taxa that were not captured with the V4 region of the 16S gene.
That's interesting. Does this Cutibacterium have just that different of the 16S gene by comparison? Because that's usually used because it's one of the most conserved genes across bacteria, right?
Yeah, I know. It's probably maybe just a couple of changes, but I know like when you edit the primers, probably one or two bases, then you're able to capture that particular species, which is very, very interesting, I think.
Yeah, agreed. That seems like it would be in conflict with RNA sequencing though, right? Because the 16S gene, which I'm sure you'll be able to capture with an RNA-seq expression, or an RNA-seq experiment, would it be the only thing that you'd be able to capture through an amplicon sequencing, right?
RNA-seq, I think so. But usually if you get ribosomal RNA, usually people just remove that. But I wonder if we can actually use that information somehow to do some taxonomy classifications through the ribosomal RNA that you can get through RNA-seq.
I gotcha. So they'd be sort of orthogonal methods. You've got one for, you know, transcriptome expression and mm-hmm. one for a taxonomic identification, and then pull them together. And now you've got a broader profile, effectively, right?
Probably. I don't know if people are doing that, but I'm guessing it can be done somehow.
It sounds like it could be done, at least. You know, take the strengths of both. Beyond the skin microbiome research, you've also recently published in ancient gut microbiomes.
Yep.
And that sounds super interesting.
Yeah, so that's actually something that I've been doing on and off for the last probably 10, 11 years. So maybe I can just talk on how that all started somehow. So back when I was a PhD student, my main topic was bacteriophages and how they can be used to track sources of fecal contamination. So nothing to do with ancient microbiomes, nothing to do with bioinformatics. So towards the last semester of my PhD or so, my PhD advisor started some collaborations with Dr. Cano, which maybe you know him. He actually was at some point, the director of microbiome research at the ATCC Center for Translational Microbiology in New Jersey. But then back then, he was actually retired and he wanted to continue working somehow. And he started these collaborations with my PhD advisor in ancient microbiomes. So with him, we started a collaboration with the archaeology department at the University of Puerto Rico. And it was interesting back then because the archaeology department actually had a number of different coprolite samples or fossilized feces that they just had there. No one ever did anything with them. And back then, and still, they had a very interesting hypothesis because they had coprolites from what they thought were two different cultures. And they thought that because based on the ceramics and other archaeological artifacts that they found in the archaeological sites, they thought that these coprolites belonged to two different cultures, but they really didn't have the evidence to show that because the main school of thought back then was that these actually were not two different cultures. These were actually just one big culture. So we thought, hey, back then we were just starting to realize that we can actually see differences in the gut microbiome that are associated with culture, lifestyles, diet. So why don't we try and look at the gut microbiomes of these coprolites and see if they're different? If they're different, they're probably just different cultures. And I remember back then, one of the main challenges was to actually get DNA from these fossilized feces, because you can imagine these are just hard as a rock, fossilized from 1500 years ago. So that was probably the first challenge. And one of the things that we decided to do first was to make sure that the DNA that we were getting was different from the inside and the outside of the coprolites. So we did that. I think probably the main challenge was actually to get DNA somehow, which we actually did, even though it was very, very small amounts. But we actually got DNA from the outside and the interior of the sample. We sequenced them using 16S and 18S back then. And we were able to demonstrate that the microbiomes of the interior and the exterior were different. So that was good to know. So we decided to concentrate on analyzing the interior of the coprolites, and through alpha diversity analysis and beta diversity and stack bar plots, we were able to show using both the 16S data and the 18S data that these actually were probably different cultures, because all the coprolites were separating in the plots based on cultures, which was very, very nice to see. And I think that was probably one of the first studies that I was involved in related to ancient microbiomes. And after that, I can say that on and off, I've been working with ancient microbiomes. After that, I did one of the postdocs in ancient microbiomes, where I was able to look at the microbiomes of ancient teeth of the same cultures. So that was a very nice way to look at the oral microbiomes of these cultures mm-hmm. that lived 1500 years ago in the Caribbean. I also was involved in characterizing the gut microbiomes of mummies from Peru and Europe. That was also a very interesting research experience. I think probably one of my favorites was characterizing the gut microbiomes of a mummy from South America. And I still remember we knew some things about her. We knew that she was a female in her 20s, and she was sacrificed as part of the rituals of these people. And it was so interesting to see and confirm through the DNA sequencing and the microbiome that she had a condition called Chagas disease, which is transmitted through a parasite, and is caused by an organism called Trypanosoma cruzi, which we were suspecting, but then with the DNA sequencing, we were able to confirm what we knew more or less about her.
Wow, that's incredible. All, I mean, collectively, that just spanned so many different concepts, different types of work.
Yeah.
I'm envious. That's so fascinating. I don't even know where to start. The Trypanosoma, still an organism of relevance, still a parasite people are very concerned with. So it's kind of interesting to hear that it's been, I mean, I'm not surprised it existed 1500 years ago, but to find evidence of it is just, I don't know, really neat to me. Yep. For lack of a better word.
Yeah.
Out of curiosity, you were talking about making sure the DNA inside and outside of the coprolites were different. Why is that significant?
It's very significant because usually when you do research around ancient microbiomes, there's going to be a lot of skepticism around your results. So you're going to have gotcha. People that will be super surprised and fascinated by the results. But then there's going to be people that will say, no, this is actually contaminants from soil or skin contaminants on how the samples were handled. So it's very important in ancient microbiomes to show and demonstrate very, very carefully that what you have is actually ancient DNA. And that's probably one of the best ways that we thought back then could demonstrate that.
Yeah, makes some sense. The I imagine this would come under quite a lot of scrutiny, and any such mistake would be the only thing that was discussed.
Yeah.
But this is amazing. I had never considered the usage of microbiome sequencing or any other flavor of analysis as really capable of being an anthropological tool as well.
Yeah, I think I didn't realize that until, yeah, I was a PhD student, and I'm still fascinated on how we can, two different fields can come together and just make history somehow. Because, for example, with these cultures that lived in the Caribbean 1500 years ago, we didn't really have any archaeological records from them. So going through all this DNA sequencing is like a way of making history somehow. We are able to know what they ate back then, their diets, their lifestyles. With these cultures, for example, we know that they ate, even though we know this from archaeological records, but now with the DNA sequencing, we know that they ate corn and tomato, and they consume tobacco somehow. And all these things, I think this is just fascinating on how the DNA sequencing data can complement the archaeology field somehow.
Have you encountered, so in the archaeology, like the ceramics, paintings, carvings, I imagine that you're saying that we have found like depictions of corn and tomatoes and such that are used as evidence that they were part of the culture. But from what little I know about modern agriculture, corn does not look the way it did 1500, 2000 years ago anymore, right? Like, well, an ear of corn.
Probably, yeah.
Right, which I think puts your work in quite the spotlight because the genetics haven't changed that much by comparison. So what might be difficult to discern from, you know, some ancient piece of artwork is almost easier through your, you know, microbiome study in a way.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that also shows the importance of having databases that have, well, at least the plants that we consume, but then that also shows that our results are limited to the databases that we have these days, because maybe they probably consume items that we don't have any DNA sequencing or no longer exist.
Yeah, the limitations of that are unfortunately an aspect that needs to be considered at the beginning of every experiment surrounding this. Plant genomes in particular are so difficult to put together, right?
I can imagine.
They're enormous. They're just so large and so complicated.
Yeah.
And by consequence, if it's not one of the most popular plants, it doesn't get studied.
Yeah, exactly.
I hate to pivot away from this because this is probably the most fascinating thing I'm gonna talk about today. But your work is impressive, not only in terms of what you do in each of these studies, but in the breadth of it, because we're talking about modern skin microbiome and ancient gut microbiomes. And you mentioned earlier that you also worked with bacteriophages and you do work in viromics as well. So I want to give that some airtime. Can you tell me a little bit about that on top of all of these other things that you've done?
Yeah. So actually, I think viromes and phages are probably one of my favorite topics. So once I completed my PhD, which actually I was working a lot with bacteriophages in the wet lab, I went to pursue a postdoc at UC San Diego in virome research. So I think back then, 10, 11 years ago, I don't think a lot of people were doing virome research. And I think still today, we don't have as many papers as microbiomes. But back then, it was something that was so, so new. So that's how I started as a postdoc. And I think it was such a good experience to work with viromes. It was probably one of my first experiences as a data scientist, even though it was my PI, the one that was processing the data upstream. He was probably the bioinformatician and I was still the data scientist. It was one of my first, experiences in working with virome research. So back then, because not a lot of people were doing virome research, I think we had the opportunity to do probably anything we wanted to with virome research. So back then, I remember he was very interested in looking at the viromes in health and disease. So we looked at the viromes in periodontal disease and how they were different from healthy individuals. He looked at the viromes of individuals after antibiotic treatment. He also looked at the viromes in individuals with urinary tract infections. And that's probably one of my favorite virome topics. I can talk a little bit about it. So maybe you remember 10, 11 years ago, we thought that urine was sterile. If there was something in there, it was probably a pathogen, something causing some type of disease. But I think
I'm sorry, can I interject real quick? This is news to me that is no longer the belief.
So actually, so back in 2012, 2011, I think people were just starting to publish papers around the urine microbiome using Sixiness. And they were just realizing that we actually have a urine microbiome that is not related to any type of disease. So we thought, hey, maybe if we have bacteria, we actually have viruses. And that's what we did. We actually collect urine samples from healthy individuals and individuals with infections. And we actually found that we have a lot of bacteriophages that have nothing to do with any type of disease. And we also found, which is probably the most fascinating discovery, at least for me back then, was that we all have some type of human papillomavirus. And we usually, when we talk about HPVs, we tend to think about cancer and infections. But the fact is that we found HPVs that we don't really know anything about, that are not related to any low or high risk infections. And to me, finding that and knowing that we have viruses that are just there, maybe not causing any disease, not doing anything, to me, that was super fascinating back then, and still it is.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've got two thoughts on that. If there is a, call it non-pathogenic HPV that you found, could it be competitive with a pathogenic version? I don't know if we have the information for that, but
That's probably a great question. I don't know if anyone has done it. Maybe, I guess those, let's say, good HPVs are there for a reason like that, just to protect us from pathogens or any low or high risk HPVs. But that's actually something that we didn't look at, but I think it actually makes sense. Just like our microbiomes protect us from pathogens, maybe some viruses protect us from bad viruses somehow.
Yeah, I would love to get my hands into that data or, you know, work with somebody on an experiment like that. I think the other thought I had is probably a little less significant, but because I already said it on the air. HPV is, I don't know if it's necessarily considered an endogenous retrovirus, but it does incorporate into the host genome in many cases. I was just wondering if you were detecting like whole HPV variants or just, that kind of incorporated, but I'm honestly not even sure if there's a significance in the difference.
Yeah. Maybe I can give more information about how we were actually detecting them. So we would do, I guess, whole genome sequencing, shotgun sequencing. Mm-hmm. But being a virome lab, we would actually try to separate the viruses from the bacteria. So that's a whole process. So some labs prefer to do that over just doing shotgun sequencing straight from the sample, because then you're able to get a higher signal of all the viruses. So back then in that lab, we would, for example, centrifuge the sample, the urine sample, take the supernatant, and then process that supernatant using cesium chloride gradient ultracentrifugation, which is a very complicated and ancient technique. And then we would do further purification of the viruses, and then we would use an extraction kit specific for viruses. So we would do all this trying to get the signal of just the viruses. So then we would do the shotgun sequencing of that fraction. And then what we would do would be to map the reads or the context against reference genomes. So back then we just downloaded all the reference genomes from all the viruses in NCBI, including HPVs. And then we will map all those reads against them. And we found a significant number of reads mapping to all these different HPV strains.
Okay, yeah, that does answer the question then. Assuming you found like pretty consistent and high coverage across those genomes, you found the whole thing. Wow. I need to look into this. This is just so neat. Anthropology by means of microbiome DNA sequencing in the modern era introduces a means to confirm findings of other studies on ancient cultures and further unravel their mysteries. The transition from laboratory scientist to data analyst and bioinformatician will be the subject of our next episode, so be sure to tune in to Behind the Biology next week.